This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, The Ruby Knight, Book 2 of the Elenium, by David Eddings. Copyright 1990 by David Eddings. All rights reserved. Narrated by John Beryl. This book contains 406 pages on 9 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player and fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the beginning of the book. Annotation. Sparhawk, a knight and the Queen's champion, searches for a way to save Queen Alana, poisoned and frozen in a block of crystal. He at last knows that the cure is the Belium, a great jewel lost over 500 years ago when King Sarek of Thalesia died in battle. Sparhawk hopes his companion Nightinian can help locate Sarek's burial place, but the year in which the queen can remain frozen is almost up. Sequel to The Diamond Throne, RC 30180. Bestseller, 1990. From the book jacket. Elana, queen of Elenia, was poisoned and frozen in crystal to save her. But the spell could only last until the last knight aiding it should die, as they were already dying one each month. Too much time and too many deaths had been spent while Sparhawk, knight and queen's champion, sought for the cure. Now the ghost of her father had summoned him to reveal that it was Primate Anius who had poisoned her, to gain free access to the treasury, that he might bribe his way to become the archprelate. And the cure for the poison was the Belium, the great jewel lost in Lamarkand when King Sarek of Thalesia died in battle 500 years ago. It had been in his crown, and since then men had searched the shores of Lake Rondera for it, vainly. Yet somehow Sparhawk must find it. Grimly he gathered his companions to go in search of it. 4 brave knights, the novice Beirut, his squire Curic, and Sophrania, the Styric instructor in magic, to the knights. At her suggestion he added the young thief Talon, and the strange little girl, Flute. The knight Tinian claimed some power in necromancy, and they hoped to gain knowledge of the dead King Sarek's burial place by raising ghosts of those who had died in battle. But the way was long, and troubles began to beset them at the outset. Azash, evil god of far eastern Zamok, had sensed their quest and sent a seeker, an evil, insectal monster of great power, to plague them. And there were other delays constantly. But Sparhawk knew that somehow they must reach and find the Belium before his queen could perish. They must not fail. Once again in this second volume of the Elenium, David Eddings proves his mastery of fantasy. Here is dark magic, high adventure, and the selfless devotion of men. And here are all the wonders that have made David Eddings a bestseller. About the author. David Eddings was born in Spokane, Washington in 1931, and was raised in the Puget Sound area north of Seattle. He received a Bachelor of Arts degree from Reed College in Portland, Oregon in 1954, and a Master of Arts degree from the University of Washington in 1961. He has served in the United States Army, has worked as a buyer for the Boeing Company, has been a grocery clerk, and has taught English. He has lived in many parts of the United States. His first novel, High Hunt, published by Putnam in 1973, was a contemporary adventure story. The field of fantasy has always been of interest to him, however, and he turned to the Belgariad in an effort to develop certain technical and philosophical ideas concerning that genre. Eddings currently resides with his wife Lee in the Southwest. Other books by David Eddings. The Belgariad, Book 1, Pawn of Prophecy, Book 2, Queen of Sorcery, Book 3, Magician's Gambit, Book 4, Castle of Wizardry, Book 5, Enchanter's Endgame, The Malorion, Book 1, Guardians of the West, Book 2, King of the Murgos, Book 3, Demon Lord of Karanda, Book 4, Sorceress of Darshiva, Book 5, The Seeress of Kell, forthcoming, The Elenium, Book 1, The Diamond Throne, Book 3, The Sapphire Rose, forthcoming. Dedication. For young Mike, put it in the car. And for Peggy, what happened to my balloons? Prologue. A History of the House of Sparhawk, from the Chronicles of the Pandion Brotherhood. It was in the 25th century when the hordes of Otha of Zemok invaded the Aline kingdoms of western Aeosia and swept all before them with fire and sword in their march to the west. Otha appeared invincible until his forces were met on the great smoke-shrouded battlefield at Lake Rondera by the combined armies of the western kingdoms and the concerted might of the Knights of the Church. The battle there in central Lemurkand is said to have raged for weeks before the invading Zemoks were finally pushed back and turned to flee for their own borders. The victory of the Alines was thus complete, but fully half of the Church knights lay slain upon the battlefield, and the armies of the Aline kings numbered their dead by the scores of thousands. When the victorious but exhausted survivors returned to their homes, they faced an even grimmer foe, the famine that is one of the common results of war. The famine in Aeosia endured for generations, threatening at times to depopulate the continent. Inevitably, social organization began to break down, and political chaos reigned in the Aline kingdoms. Rogue barons paid only lip service to their oaths of fealty to their kings. Private disputes often resulted in ugly little wars, and open banditry was common. These conditions generally prevailed until well into the early years of the 27th century. It was in this time of turmoil that an acolyte appeared at the gates of our mother house at Deimos, expressing an earnest desire to become a member of our order. As his training began, our preceptor soon realized that this young postulant, Sparhawk by name, was no ordinary man. He quickly outstripped his fellow novices, and even mastered seasoned pandions on the practice field. It was not merely his physical prowess, however, that so distinguished him, since his intellectual gifts were also towering. His aptitude for the secrets of Styricum was the delight of his tutor in those arts, and the aged Styric instructor guided his pupil into areas of magic far beyond those customarily taught the Pandion knights. The Patriarch of Deimos was no less enthusiastic about the intellect of this novice, and by the time Sir Sparhawk had won his spurs, he was also skilled in the intricacies of philosophy and theological disputation. It was at about the same time that Sir Sparhawk was knighted that the youthful King Antor ascended the Alanian throne in Cimera, and the lives of the two young men soon became intricately intertwined. King Antor was a rash, even foolhardy youth, and an outbreak of banditry along his northern border enraged him to the point where he threw caution to the winds and mounted a punitive expedition into that portion of his kingdom with a woefully inadequate force. When word of this reached Deimos, the preceptor of the Pandion knights dispatched a relief column to rush north to the king's aid, and among the knights in that column was Sir Sparhawk. King Antor was soon far out of his depth. Although no one could dispute his personal bravery, his lack of experience often led him into serious tactical and strategic blunders. Since he was oblivious to the alliances between the various bandit barons of the northern marches, he oft-times led his men against one of them without giving thought to the fact that another was very likely to come to the aid of his ally. Thus King Antor's already seriously outnumbered force was steadily whittled down by surprise attacks directed at the rear of his army. The barons of the north gleefully outflanked him again and again as he charged blindly forward, and they steadily decimated his reserves. And so it stood when Sparhawk and the other Pandion knights arrived in the war zone. The armies that had been so sorely pressing the young king were largely untrained, a rabble recruited from local robber bands. The barons who led them fell back to take stock of the situation. Although their numbers were still overwhelming, the reputed skill of the Pandions on the battlefield was something to be taken into account. A few of their number, made rash by their previous successes, urged their allies to press the attack. But older and wiser men advised caution. It seems relatively certain that a fair number of the barons, young and old alike, saw the way to the throne of Alania opening before them. Should King Antor fall in battle, his crown might easily become the property of any man strong enough to wrest it from his companions. The barons' first attacks on the combined forces of the Pandions and King Antor's troops were tentative, more in the nature of tests of the strength and resolve of the Church knights and their allies. When it became evident that the response was in large measure defensive, these assaults grew more serious, and ultimately there was a pitched battle not far from the Pelosian border. As soon as it became evident that the barons were committing their full forces to the struggle, the Pandions reacted with their customary savagery. The defensive posture they had adopted during the first probing attacks had been clearly a ruse, designed to lure the barons into an all-out confrontation. The battle raged for the better part of a spring day. Late in the afternoon, when bright sunlight flooded the field, King Antor became separated from the troops of his household guard. He found himself horseless and hard-pressed, and he resolved to sell his life as dearly as possible. It was at this point that Sir Sparhawk entered the fray. He quickly cut his way through to the king's side, and in the fashion as old as the history of warfare, the two stood back to back, holding off their foes. The combination of Antor's headstrong bravery and Sparhawk's skill was convincing enough to hold their enemies at bay until, by mischance, Sparhawk's sword was broken. With triumphant shouts, the force encircling the two rushed in for the kill. This proved to be a fatal error. Snatching a short, broad-bladed battle spear from one of the fallen, Sparhawk decimated the ranks of the charging troops. The culmination of the struggle came when the swarthy-faced baron who had been leading the attack rushed in to slay the sorely wounded Antor, and died with Sparhawk's spear in his vitals. The baron's fall demoralized his men. They fell back and ultimately fled the scene. Antor's wounds were grave, and Sparhawk's only slightly less so. Exhausted, the two sank side by side to the ground as evening settled over the field. It is impossible to reconstruct the conversation of the two wounded men there on that bloody field during the early hours of the night, since in later years neither would reveal what had passed between them. What is known, however, is that at some point during their discussions they traded weapons. Antor bestowed the royal sword of Alania upon Sir Sparhawk, and took in exchange the battle spear with which Sir Sparhawk had saved his life. The king was to cherish that rude weapon to the end of his days. It was nearly midnight when the two injured men saw a torch approaching through the darkness, and not knowing if the torch-bearer was friend or foe, they struggled to their feet and wearily prepared to defend themselves. The one who approached, however, was not an Aline, but was rather a white-robed and hooded Styric woman. Wordlessly, she tended their wounds. Then she spoke to them briefly in a lilting voice, and gave them the pair of rings that came to symbolize their lifelong friendship. Tradition has it that the oval stones set in the rings were as pale as diamond when the two received them, but that their mingled blood permanently stained the stones, and they appear to this day to be deep red rubies. Once she had done this, the mysterious Styric woman turned without a further word and walked off into the night, her white robe glowing in the moonlight. As misty dawn lightened the field, the troops of Antor's household guard and a number of Sparhawk's fellow Pandions found the two wounded men at last, and they were borne on litters to our mother house here at Deimos. Their recovery consumed months. By the time they were well enough to travel, they were fast friends. They went by easy stages to Antor's capital at Cimera, and there the king made a startling announcement. He declared that henceforth the Pandion Sparhawk would be his champion, and that so long as both their families survived, the descendants of Sparhawk would serve the rulers of Alania in that capacity. As inevitably happens, the king's court at Cimera was filled with intrigues. The various factions, however, were taken aback somewhat by the appearance at court of the grim-faced Sir Sparhawk. After a few tentative attempts to enlist his support for this or that faction had been sternly rebuffed, the courtiers uncomfortably concluded that the king's champion was incorruptible. Moreover, the friendship between the king and Sparhawk made the Pandion knight the king's confidant and closest adviser. Since Sparhawk, as has been pointed out, had a towering intellect, he easily saw through the oft-times petty scheming of the various officials at court, and brought them to the attention of his less gifted friend. Within a year, the court of King Antor had become remarkably free of corruption, as Sparhawk imposed his own rigid morality upon those around him. Of even greater concern to the various political factions in Alania was the growing influence of the Pandion order in the kingdom. King Antor was profoundly grateful not only to Sir Sparhawk, but also to his champion's brother knights. The king and his friend journeyed often to Deimos to confer with the preceptor of our order, and major policy decisions were more often made in the mother house than in the chambers of the royal council, where courtiers had customarily dictated royal policy with an eye more to their own advantage than to the good of the kingdom. Sir Sparhawk married in middle life, and his wife soon bore him a son. At Antor's request, the child was also named Sparhawk, a tradition which, once established, has continued unbroken in the family to this very day. When he had reached a suitable age, the younger Sparhawk entered the Pandion mother house to begin the training for the position he would one day fill. To their father's delight, young Sparhawk and Antor's son, the Crown Prince, had become close friends during their boyhood, and the relationship between king and champion was thus ensured to continue unbroken. When Antor, filled with years and honors, lay on his deathbed, his last act was to bestow his ruby ring and the short, broad-bladed spear upon his son. At the same time, the elder Sparhawk passed his ring and the royal sword on to his son. This tradition has also persisted down to this very day. It is widely believed among the common people of Elenia that for so long as the friendship between the royal family and the House of Sparhawk shall persist, the kingdom will prosper, and that no evil can befall it. Like many superstitions, this one is to some degree based in fact. The descendants of Sparhawk have always been gifted men, and in addition to their pantheon training, they have also received special instruction in statecraft and diplomacy, the better to prepare them for their hereditary task. Of late, however, there has been a rift between the royal family and the House of Sparhawk. The weak King Aldreas, dominated by his ambitious sister and the Primate of Cimera, rather coldly relegated the current Sparhawk to the lesser, even demeaning position as caretaker of the person of Princess Elana, possibly in the hope that the champion would be so offended that he would renounce his hereditary position. So Sparhawk, however, took his duty seriously, and educated the child who would one day be Queen of Elenia in those areas that would prepare her to rule. When it became obvious that Sparhawk would not willingly give up his post, Aldreas, at the instigation of his sister and Primate Annius, sent the knight Sparhawk into exile in the kingdom of Rendor. Upon the death of King Aldreas, his daughter Elana ascended the throne as queen. Hearing this news, Sparhawk returned to Cimera, only to find that his young queen was gravely ill, and that her life was being sustained only by a spell cast by the Styrix sorceress Sifrania, a spell, however, which could keep Elana alive for no more than a year. In consultation, the preceptors of the four militant orders of church knights decided that the four orders must work in concert to discover a cure for the queen's illness and to restore her to health and power, lest the corrupt primate Annius achieve his goal, the throne of the archprelacy in the Basilica of Kyrillos. To that end, the preceptors of the Cyrenix, the Alcyones, and the Genidians dispatched their own champions to join with the Pandion Sparhawk and his boyhood friend Colton to seek out the cure that would not only restore Queen Elana, but also her kingdom, which suffered in her absence from a grave malaise. Thus it stands. The restoration of the queen's health is vital not only to the kingdom of Elenia, but to the other Elene kingdoms as well. For should the venal primate Annius gain the archprelate's throne, we may be sure that the Elene kingdoms will be racked by turmoil, and our ancient foe Otha of Zamok stands poised on our eastern frontier, ready to exploit any division or chaos. The cure of the queen who is so near to death, however, may daunt even her champion and his stalwart companions. Pray for their success, my brothers, for should they fail, the whole of the Eosian continent will inevitably fall into general warfare, and civilization as we know it will cease to exist. Part 1. Lake Rondera. Chapter 1. It was well after midnight, and a dense gray fog had crept in off the Cimera River to mingle with the pervading wood smoke from a thousand chimneys, to blur the nearly deserted streets of the city. The Pandion knight Sir Sparhawk nonetheless moved cautiously, keeping to the shadows whenever possible. The streets glistened with moisture, and pale rainbow-colored halos surrounded the torches, trying feebly with their guttering light to illuminate streets into which no sensible man ventured at this hour. The houses lining the street Sparhawk was following were hardly more than looming black shadows. Sparhawk moved on, his ears even more than his eyes wary, for in this murky night sound was far more important than sight to warn of approaching danger. This was a bad time to be out. By day, Cimera was no more dangerous than any other city. By night, it was a jungle where the strong fed upon the weak and unwary. Sparhawk, however, was neither of those. Beneath his plain traveler's cloak, he wore chain mail, and a heavy sword hung at his side. In addition, he carried a short, broad-bladed battle spear loosely in one hand. He was trained, moreover, in levels of violence no footpad could match, and a seething anger inflamed him at this point. Bleakly, the broken-nosed man almost hoped that some fool might try an attack. When provoked, Sparhawk was not the most reasonable of men, and he had been provoked of late. He was also, however, aware of the urgency of what he was about. Much as he might have taken some satisfaction in the rush and cut and slash of a meeting with unknown and unimportant assailants, he had responsibilities. His pale young queen hovered near death, and she silently demanded absolute fidelity from her champion. He would not betray her, and to die in some muddy gutter as a result of a meaningless encounter would not serve the queen he was oath-bound to protect. And so it was that he moved cautiously, his feet more silent than those of any paid assassin. Somewhere ahead he saw the bobbing of hazy-looking torches, and heard the measured tread of several men marching in unison. He muttered an oath, and ducked up a smelly alley. A half-dozen men marched by, their red tunics bedewed by the fog, and with long pikes leaning slantwise over their shoulders. "It's that place in Rose Street," their officer was saying arrogantly, "where the Pandions try to hide their ungodly subterfuge. They know we're watching, of course, but our presence restricts their movements and leaves His Grace the Primate free from their interference." "We know the reasons, Lieutenant," a bored-sounding corporal said. "We've been doing this for over a year now." "Oh," the self-important young lieutenant sounded a bit crestfallen. "I just want to be sure that we all understood, is all." "Yes, sir," the corporal said tonelessly. "Wait here, men," the lieutenant said, trying to make his boyish voice sound gruff. "I'll look on ahead." He marched on up the street, his heels smashing noisily on the fog-wet cobblestones. "What a jackass," the corporal muttered to his companions. "Grow up, corporal," an old gray-haired veteran said. "We take the pay so we obey their orders and keep our opinions to ourselves. Just do your job and leave opinions to the officers." The corporal grunted sourly. "I was at court yesterday," he said. "Primate Annius had summoned that young puppy up there, and the fool absolutely had to have an escort. Would you believe the lieutenant was actually fawning all over the bastard like Chaos?" "That's what lieutenants do best," the veteran shrugged. "They're born bootlickers, and the bastard is the Prince Regent, after all. I'm not sure if that makes his boots taste any better, but the lieutenant's probably got calluses on his tongue by now." The corporal laughed. "That's God's truth, but wouldn't he be surprised if the queen recovered and he found out that he'd eaten all that boot polish for nothing?" "You'd better hope she doesn't, corporal," one of the other men said. "If she wakes up and takes control of her own treasury again, Annius won't have the money to pay us next month." "He can always dip into the church coffers." "Not without giving an accounting, he can't. The hierocracy in Kyrillos squeezes every penny of church money until it squeaks." "All right, you men," the young officer called out of the fog. "The Pandion Inn is just up ahead. I've relieved the soldiers who were on watch, so we'd better go there and take up our positions."
"You heard him," the corporal said. "Move out." The church soldiers marched off into the fog.
Sparhawk smiled briefly in the darkness. It was seldom that he had the opportunity to hear the casual conversations of the enemy. He had long suspected that the soldiers of the Primate of Cimera were motivated more by greed than from any sense of loyalty or piety. He stepped out of the alley and then jumped soundlessly back, as he heard other footsteps coming up the street. For some reason, the usually empty nighttime streets of Cimera were awash with people. The footsteps were loud, so whoever it was out there was not trying to sneak up on anybody. Sparhawk shifted the short-handled spear in his hands. Then he saw the fellow looming out of the fog. The man wore a dark-colored smock, and he had a large basket balanced on one shoulder. He appeared to be a workman of some kind, but there was no way to be sure of that. Sparhawk remained silent and let him pass. He waited until the sound of the footsteps was gone. Then he stepped into the street again. He walked carefully, his soft boots making little sound on the wet cobblestones, and he kept his gray cloak wrapped tightly about him to muffle any clinking of his chainmail. He crossed an empty street to avoid the flickering yellow lamplight coming through the open door of a tavern, where voices were raised in bawdy song. He shifted the spear to his left hand and pulled the hood of his cloak even farther forward to shadow his face as he passed through the mist-shrouded light. He stopped, his eyes and ears carefully searching the foggy street ahead of him. His general direction was toward the east gate, but he had no particular fanaticism about that. People who walk in straight lines are predictable, and predictable people get caught. It was absolutely vital that he leave the city unrecognized and unseen by any of Annie's men, even if it took him all night. When he was satisfied that the street was empty, he moved on, keeping to the deepest shadows. At a corner beneath a misty orange torch, a ragged beggar sat against a wall. He had a bandage across his eyes, and a number of authentic-looking sores on his arms and legs. Sparhawk knew that this was not a profitable time for begging, so the fellow was probably up to something else. Then a slate from a rooftop crashed into the street not far from where Sparhawk stood.
"Charity!"
the beggar called in a despairing voice, although Sparhawk's soft-shod feet had made no sound. "Good evening, neighbor," the big knight said softly, crossing the street. He dropped a couple of coins into the begging bowl.
"Thank you, my lord. Bless you."
"You're not supposed to be able to see me, neighbor," Sparhawk reminded him. "You don't know if I'm a lord or a commoner."
"It's late," the beggar apologized, "and I'm a little sleepy. Sometimes I forget."
"Very sloppy," Sparhawk chided. "Pay attention to business. Oh, by the way, give my best to Platamy." Platamy was an enormously fat man who ruled the underside of Cimera with an iron fist. The beggar lifted the bandage from his eyes and stared at Sparhawk, his eyes widening in recognition. "And tell your friend up on that roof not to get excited," Sparhawk added. "You might tell him, though, to watch where he puts his feet. That last slate he kicked loose almost brained me."
"He's a new man," the beggar sniffed. "He still has a lot to learn about burglary."
"That he does," Sparhawk agreed. "Maybe you can help me, neighbor. Talon was telling me about a tavern up against the east wall of the city. It's supposed to have a garret that the tavern keeper rents out from time to time. Do you happen to know where it's located?"
"It's in Goat Lane," says Sparhawk. "It's got a sign that's supposed to look like a bunch of grapes. You can't miss it."
The beggar squinted.
"Where's Talon been lately? I haven't seen him for quite a while."
"His father's sort of taken him in hand."
"I didn't know Talon even had a father. That boy will go far if he doesn't get himself hanged. He's just about the best thief in Cimera."
"I know," Sparhawk said. "He's picked my pocket a few times." He dropped a couple more coins in the begging bowl. "I'd appreciate it if you'd keep the fact that you saw me tonight more or less to yourself, neighbor."
"I never saw you, Sir Sparhawk,"
the beggar grinned. "And I never saw you and your friend on the roof, either."
"Something for everybody, then."
"My feelings exactly. Good luck in your enterprise."
"And the same to you and yours."
Sparhawk smiled and moved off down the street. His brief exposure to the seamier side of Cimmeran society had paid off again. Though not exactly a friend, Platamy and the shadowy world he controlled could be very helpful. Sparhawk cut over one street to make sure that should the clumsy burglar on the roof be surprised in the course of his activities, the inevitable hue and cry would not bring the watch running down the same street he was traversing. As they always did when he was alone, Sparhawk's thoughts reverted to his queen. He had known Alana since she had been a little girl, though he had not seen her during the 10 years he had been in exile in Rendor. The memory of her seated on her throne, encased in diamond-hard crystal, wrenched at his heart. He began to regret the fact that he had not taken advantage of the opportunity to kill the primate Annius earlier tonight. A poisoner is always contemptible, but the man who had poisoned Sparhawk's queen had placed himself in mortal danger, since Sparhawk was not one to let old scores simmer too long. Then he heard furtive footsteps behind him in the fog, and he stepped into a recessed doorway and stood very still. There were two of them, and they wore nondescript clothing.
"Can you still see him?"
one of them whispered to the other.
"No! This fog's getting thicker. He's just ahead of us, though." "Are you sure he's a Pandion? When you've been in this business as long as I have, you'll learn to recognize them. It's the way they walk and the way they hold their shoulders. He's a Pandion, all right. What's he doing out in the street at this time of night?" That's what we're here to find out. The primate wants reports on all their movements. The notion of trying to sneak up behind a Pandion on a foggy night makes me just a little nervous. They all use magic, and they can feel you coming. I'd rather not get his sword in my guts. Did you ever see his face?
No. He had his hood up, so his face was in shadow.
The two of them crept on up the street, unaware of the fact that their lives had hung in the balance for a moment. Had either of them seen Sparhawk's face, they would have died on the spot. Sparhawk was a very pragmatic man about things like that. He waited until he could no longer hear their footfalls. Then he retraced his steps to an intersection and went up a side street. The tavern was empty except for the owner, who dozed with his feet up on a table and with his hands clasped over his paunch. He was a stout, unshaven man wearing a dirty smock.
"Good evening, neighbor," Sparhawk said quietly as he entered. The tavern keeper opened one eye.
"Morning is more like it," he grunted.
Sparhawk looked around. The tavern was a fairly typical working man's place, with a low-beamed ceiling smudged with smoke, and with a utilitarian counter across the back. The chairs and benches were scarred, and the sawdust on the floor had not been swept up and replaced for months.
"It seems to be a slow night," he noted in his quiet voice.
"It's always slow this late, friend. What's your pleasure?"
"Arsham Red, if you've got any."
"Arsham's hip deep in red grapes. Nobody ever runs out of Arsham Red."
With a weary sigh, the tavern keeper heaved himself to his feet and poured Sparhawk a goblet of red wine. The goblet, Sparhawk saw, was none too clean.
"You're out late, friend," the fellow observed, handing the big knight the sticky goblet.
"Business," Sparhawk shrugged. "A friend of mine said you have a garret on the top floor of the house."
The tavern keeper's eyes narrowed suspiciously.
"You don't look like the sort of fellow who'd have a burning interest in garrets," he said. "Does this friend of yours have a name?"
"Not one he cares to have generally known," Sparhawk replied, taking a sip of his wine. It was a distinctly inferior vintage.
"Friend, I don't know you, and you have a sort of official look about you. Why don't you just finish your wine and leave? That's unless you can come up with a name I can recognize."
"This friend of mine works for a man named Platamy. You may have heard the name."
The tavern keeper's eyes widened slightly.
"Platamy must be branching out. I didn't know that he had anything to do with the gentry except to steal from them."
Sparhawk shrugged. "He owed me a favor."
The unshaven man still looked dubious.
"Anybody could throw Platamy's name around," he said.
"Neighbor," Sparhawk said flatly, setting his wine glass down, "this is starting to get tedious. Either we go up to your garret or I go out looking for the watch. I'm sure they'll be very interested in your little enterprise."
The tavern keeper's face grew sullen.
"It'll cost you a silver half crown."
"All right."
"You're not even going to argue?"
"I'm in a bit of a hurry. We can haggle about the price next time."
"You seem to be in quite a rush to get out of town, friend. You haven't killed anybody with that spear tonight, have you?"
"Not yet."
Sparhawk's voice was flat. The tavern keeper swallowed hard.
"Let me see your money."
"Of course, neighbor. And then let's go upstairs and have a look at this garret."
"We'll have to be careful. With this fog, you won't be able to see the guards coming along the parapet."
"I can take care of that."
"No killing. I've got a nice little sideline here. If somebody kills one of the guards, I'll have to close it down."
"Don't worry, neighbor. I don't think I'll have to kill anybody tonight."
The garret was dusty and appeared unused. The tavern keeper carefully opened the gabled window and peered out into the fog. Behind him, Sparhawk whispered in Styric and released the spell. He could feel the fellow out there.
"Careful," he said quietly. "There's a guard coming along the parapet."
"I don't see anybody."
"I heard him," Sparhawk replied.
There was no point in going into extended explanations.
"You've got sharp ears, friend."
The two of them waited in the darkness as the sleepy guard strolled along the parapet and disappeared in the fog.
"Give me a hand with this," the tavern keeper said, stooping to lift one end of a heavy timber up onto the windowsill. "We slide it across to the parapet, and then you go on over. When you get there, I'll throw you the end of this rope. It's anchored here, so you'll be able to slide down the outside of the wall."
"Right," Sparhawk said. They slid the timber across the intervening space.
"Thanks, neighbor," Sparhawk said.
He straddled the timber and inched his way across to the parapet. He stood up and caught the coil of rope that came out of the misty darkness. He dropped it over the wall and swung out on it. A few moments later, he was on the ground. The rope slithered up into the fog, and then he heard the sound of the timber sliding back into the garret.
"Very neat," Sparhawk muttered, walking carefully away from the city wall. "I'll have to remember that place."
The fog made it a bit difficult to get his bearings, but by keeping the looming shadow of the city wall to his left, he could more or less determine his location. He set his feet down carefully. The night was quiet. The sound of a stick breaking would be very loud. Then he stopped. Sparhawk's instincts were very good, and he knew that he was being watched. He drew his sword slowly to avoid the telltale sound it made as it slid out of its sheath. With the sword in one hand and the battle spear in the other, he stood peering out into the fog. And then he saw it. It was only a faint glow in the darkness, so faint that most people would not have noticed it. The glow drew closer, and he saw that it had a slight greenish cast to it. Sparhawk stood perfectly still and waited. There was a figure out there in the fog, indistinct perhaps, but a figure nonetheless. It appeared to be robed and hooded in black, and that faint glow seemed to be coming out from under the hood. The figure was quite tall and appeared to be impossibly thin, almost skeletal. For some reason, it chilled Sparhawk. He muttered in Styrek, moving his fingers on the hilt of the sword and the shaft of the spear. Then he raised the spear and released the spell with its point. The spell was a relatively simple one, its purpose being only to identify the emaciated figure out in the fog. Sparhawk almost gasped when he felt the waves of pure evil emanating from the shadowy form. Whatever it was certainly not human. After a moment, a ghostly metallic chuckle came out of the night. The figure turned and moved away. Its walk was jerky, as if its knees were put together backward. Sparhawk stayed where he was until that sense of evil faded away. Whatever the thing was, it was gone now. "I wonder if that was another of Martell's little surprises," Sparhawk muttered under his breath. Martell was a renegade Pandion knight who had been expelled from the Order. He and Sparhawk had once been friends, but no more. Martell now worked for Primate Anius, and it had been he who had provided the poison with which Anius had very nearly killed the Queen. Sparhawk continued slowly and silently now, his sword and the spear still in his hands. Finally, he saw the torches that marked the closed east gate of the city, and he took his bearings from them. Then he heard a faint snuffling sound behind him, much like the sound a tracking dog would make. He turned, his weapons ready. Again he heard that metallic chuckle. He amended that in his mind. It was not so much a chuckle as it was a sort of stridulation, a chittering sound. Again he felt that sense of overpowering evil, which once again faded away. Sparhawk angled slightly out from the city wall and the filmy light of those two torches at the gate. After about a quarter of an hour, he saw the square looming shape of the Pandion chapter house just ahead. He dropped into a prone position on the fog-wet turf and cast the searching spell again. He released it and waited. Nothing. He rose, sheathed his sword, and moved cautiously across the intervening field. The castle-like chapter house was, as always, being watched. Church soldiers dressed as workmen were encamped not far from the front gate with piles of the cobblestones they were ostensibly laying heaped around their tents. Sparhawk, however, went around to the back wall and carefully picked his way through the deep, stake-studded fosse surrounding the structure. The rope down which he had clambered when he had left the house was still dangling behind a concealing bush. He shook it a few times to be certain the grappling hook at its upper end was still firmly attached. Then he tucked the war spear under his sword belt. He grasped the rope and pulled down hard. Above him he could hear the points of the hook grating into the stones of the battlement. He started to climb up, hand over hand.
"Who's there?"
The voice came sharply out of the fog overhead. It was a youthful voice, unfamiliar. Sparhawk swore under his breath. Then he felt a tugging on the rope he was climbing. "Leave it alone, Bayret," he grated, straining to pull himself up.
"Sir Sparhawk?"
the novice said in a startled voice. "Don't jerk on the rope," Sparhawk ordered. "Those stakes in the ditch are very sharp."
"Let me help you up."
"I can manage. Just don't displace that hook." He grunted as he heaved himself up over the battlement, and Bayret caught his arm to help him. Sparhawk was sweating from his exertions. Climbing a rope when one is wearing chain mail can be very strenuous. Bayret was a novice Pandion who showed much promise. He was a tall, raw-boned young man who was wearing a mail shirt and a plain, utilitarian cloak. He carried a heavy bladed battle-axe in one hand. He was a polite young fellow, so he did not ask any questions, although his face was filled with curiosity. Sparhawk looked down into the courtyard of the chapter house. By the light of a flickering torch, he saw Keurig and Colton. Both of them were armed, and sounds from the stable indicated that someone was saddling horses for them. "Don't go away," he called down to them.
"What are you doing up there, Sparhawk?"
Colton sounded surprised. "I thought I'd take up burglary as a sideline," Sparhawk replied dryly. "Stay there. I'll be right down. Come along, Bayret."
"I'm supposed to be on watch, Sir Sparhawk."
"We'll send somebody up to replace you. This is important." Sparhawk led the way along the parapet to the steep stone stairs that led down into the courtyard.
"Where have you been, Sparhawk?"
Keurig demanded angrily when the two had descended. Sparhawk's squire wore his usual black leather vest, and his heavily muscled arms and shoulders gleamed in the orange torchlight that illuminated the courtyard. He spoke in the hushed voice men use when talking at night.
"I had to go to the cathedral," Sparhawk replied quietly. "Are you having religious experiences?" Colton asked, sounding amused.
The big blonde knight, Sparhawk's boyhood friend, was dressed in chain and had a heavy broadsword belted at his waist.
"Not exactly," Sparhawk told him. "Tanis is dead. His ghost came to me about midnight."
"Tanis?"
Colton's voice was shocked. "He was one of the 12 knights who were with Sophrania when she encased Alana in crystal. His ghost told me to go to the crypt under the cathedral before it went to give up its sword to Sophrania."
"And you went? At night?"
"The matter was of a certain urgency."
"What did you do there? Violate a few tombs? Is that how you got the spear?"
"Hardly," Sparhawk replied. "King Aldreus gave it to me."
"Aldreus?"
"His ghost, anyway. His missing ring is hidden in the socket." Sparhawk looked curiously at his two friends. "Where were you going just now?"
"Out to look for you."
Keurig shrugged. "How did you know I'd left the chapter house?"
"I checked in on you a few times," Keurig said.
"I thought you knew I usually did that."
"Every night?"
"Three times at least," Keurig confirmed.
"I've been doing that every night since you were a boy, except for the year you were in Rendor.
The first time tonight you were talking in your sleep. The second time, just after midnight, you were gone. I looked around, and when I couldn't find you, I woke up Colton."
"I think we'd better go wake the others," Sparhawk said bleakly. "Aldreus told me some things, and we've got some decisions to make."
"Bad news?"
Colton asked.
"It's hard to say.
Bayret, tell those novices in the stable to go replace you on the parapet. This might take a while." They gathered in Preceptor Vanion's brown-carpeted study in the South Tower. Sparhawk, Bayret, Colton, and Keurig were there, of course. Sabavia, a Cyrenic knight, was there as well, as were Sir Tinian, an Alcyone knight, and Sir Euloth, a huge Genidian knight. The three were the champions of their orders, and they had joined with Sparhawk and Colton when the preceptors of the four orders had decided that the restoration of Queen Alana was a matter that concerned them all. Sophrania, The small, dark-haired Styrek woman who had instructed the Pandions in the secrets of Styrekum sat by the fire with the little girl they called Flute at her side. The boy, Talon, sat by the window, rubbing at his eyes with his fists. Talon was a sound sleeper, and he did not like being awakened. Vanion, the preceptor of the Pandion Knights, sat at the table he used for a writing desk. His study was a pleasant room, low, dark-beamed, and with a deep fireplace that Sparhawk had never seen unlighted. As always, Sifrania's simmering tea kettle stood on the hob. Vanion did not look well. Roused from his bed in the middle of the night, the preceptor of the Pandion Order, a grim, careworn knight who was probably even older than he looked, wore an uncharacteristic Styrek robe of plain white homespun cloth. Sparhawk had watched this peculiar change in Vanion over the years. Caught at times unawares, the preceptor, one of the stalwarts of the church, sometimes seemed almost half Styrek. As an Aline and a knight of the church, it was Sparhawk's duty to reveal his observations to the church authorities. He chose, however, not to. His loyalty to the church was one thing, a commandment from God. His loyalty to Vanion, however, was deeper, more personal. The preceptor was gray-faced, and his hands trembled slightly. The burden of the swords of the three dead knights he had compelled Sifrania to relinquish to him was obviously weighing him down more than he would have admitted. The spell Sifrania had cast in the throne room, and which sustained the queen, had involved the concerted assistance of 12 Pandion knights. One by one, those knights would die, and their ghosts would deliver their swords to Sifrania. When the last had died, she would follow them into the House of the Dead. Earlier that evening, Vanion had compelled her to give those swords to him. It was not the weight of the swords alone that made them such a burden. There were other things that went with them, things about which Sparhawk could not even begin to guess. Vanion had been adamant about taking the swords. He had given a few vague reasons for his action, but Sparhawk privately suspected that the preceptor's main reason had been to spare Sifrania as much as possible. Despite all the strictures forbidding such things, Sparhawk believed that Vanion loved the dear, small woman who had instructed all Pandions for generations in the secrets of Styrekum. All Pandion knights loved and revered Sifrania. In Vanion's case, however, Sparhawk surmised that love and reverence went perhaps a step further. Sifrania also, he had noticed, seemed to have a special affection for the preceptor that went somehow beyond the love of a teacher for her pupil. This was also something that a church knight should reveal to the hierocracy in Kyrellos. Again, Sparhawk chose not to. "Why are we gathering at this unseemly hour?" Vanion asked wearily. "Do you want to tell him?" Sparhawk asked Sifrania. The white-robed woman sighed and unwrapped the long cloth-bound object she held to reveal another ceremonial Pandion sword. "Sotanis has gone into the House of the Dead," she told Vanion sadly.
"Tanis?"
Vanion's voice was stricken.
"When did this happen?"
"Just recently, I gather," she replied.
"Is that why we're here tonight?" Vanion asked Sparhawk. "Not entirely. Before he went to deliver his sword to Sifrania, Tanis visited me, or at least his ghost did. He told me that someone in the royal crypt wanted to see me. I went to the cathedral, and I was confronted by the ghost of Aldreus. He told me a number of things, and then gave me this." He twisted the shaft of the spear out of its socket and shook the ruby ring from its place of concealment. "So that's where Aldreus hid it," Vanion said. "Maybe he was wiser than we thought. You said he told you some things."
"Such as what?"
"That he had been poisoned," Sparhawk replied. "Probably the same poison they gave Alana."
"Was it Aeneas?" Colton asked grimly.
Sparhawk shook his head.
"No. It was Princess Orisa."
"His own sister?" Bavior exclaimed. "That's monstrous."
Bavior was an Arshan, and he had deep moral convictions.
"Orisa's fairly monstrous," Colton agreed. "She's not the sort to let little things stand in her way.
How did she get out of the cloister in Deimos to dispose of Aldreus, though?"
"Aeneas arranged it," Sparhawk told him.
She entertained Aldreas in her usual fashion, and when he was exhausted, she gave him the poisoned wine.
I don't quite understand, Xavier frowned.
The relationship between Arissa and Aldreas went somewhat beyond what is customary for a brother and sister, Vanion told him delicately. Xavier's eyes widened, and the blood drained from his olive-skinned face as he slowly gathered Vanion's meaning.
Why did she kill him? Calton asked. Revenge for locking her up in that cloister?
No, I don't think so, Sparhawk told him. I think it was a part of the overall scheme she and Annius had hatched. First they poisoned Aldreas, and then Alana.
So the way to the throne would be clear for Arissa's bastard son?
Calton surmised. It's sort of logical, Sparhawk agreed. It fits together even tighter when you know that Lycaeus the Bastard is Annius' son, too.
A primate of the church, Tinian said, looking a bit startled. Do you people here in Alania have different rules from the rest of us?
Not really, no, Vanion replied. Annius seems to feel that he's above the rules, and Arissa goes out of her way to break them.
Arissa's always been just a little indiscriminate, Calton added. Rumor has it that she was on very friendly terms with just about every man in Cimera.
That might be a slight exaggeration, Vanion said. He stood up and went to the window.
I'll pass this information on to Patriarch Dolmant, he said, looking out at the foggy night. He may be able to make some use of it when the time comes to elect a new archprelate.
And perhaps the Earl of Lenda might be able to use it as well, Sophrania suggested. The Royal Council is corrupt. But even they might balk if they find that Annius is trying to put his own bastard son on the throne. She looked at Sparhawk.
What else did Aldreas tell you? She asked.
Just one other thing. We know we need some magic object to cure Alana. He told me what it is. It's Belium. It's the only thing in the world with enough power.
Sophrania's face blanched. No, she gasped. Not Belium.
That's what he told me. It presents a big problem, Euleth declared. Belium's been lost since the Zaymok War, and even if we're lucky enough to find it, it won't respond unless we have the rings.
Rings? Calton asked. The troll dwarf Gwerig made Belium, Euleth explained. Then he made a pair of rings to unlock its power. Without the rings, Belium's useless.
We already have the rings, Sophrania told him absently. Her face still troubled.
We do?
Sparhawk was startled.
You're wearing one of them, she told him, and Aldreas gave you the other this very night.
Sparhawk stared at the ruby ring on his left hand, then back at his teacher.
How's that possible? He demanded. How did my ancestor and King Antor come by these particular rings?
I gave them to them, she replied. He blinked.
Sophrania, that was 300 years ago.
Yes, she agreed. Approximately. Sparhawk stared at her, then swallowed hard.
300 years? He demanded incredulously.
Sophrania, just how old are you?
You know I'm not going to answer that question, Sparhawk. I've told you that before.
How did you get the rings?
My goddess Afrael gave them to me, along with certain instructions. She told me where I'd find your ancestor and King Antor, and she told me to deliver the rings to them.
Little mother, Sparhawk began, and then broke off as he saw her bleak expression.
Hush, dear one, she commanded. I will say this only once, Sir Knights, she told them all. What we do puts us in conflict with the elder gods. And that is not likely undertaken. Your Aline god forgives. The younger gods of Styricum can be persuaded to relent. The elder gods, however, demand absolute compliance with their whims. To counter the commands of an elder god is to court worse than death. They obliterate those who defy them, in ways you cannot imagine. Do we really want to bring Belium back into the light again?
Sophrania, we have to! Sparhawk exclaimed. It's the only way we can save Alana, and you and Vanion, for that matter.
Aeneas will not live forever, Sparhawk, and Lycaeus is hardly more than an inconvenience. Vanion and I are temporary, and so, for that matter, regardless of how you feel personally, is Alana. The world won't miss any of us all that much. Sophrenia's tone was almost clinical. Eliom, however, is another matter, and so is Azash. If we fail and put the stone into that foul god's hands, we will doom the world forever. Is it worth the risk?
I'm the queen's champion, Sparhawk reminded her. I have to do whatever I possibly can to save her life. He rose and strode across the room to her. So help me God, Sophrenia, he declared. I'll break open hell itself to save that girl.
Sophrenia sighed. He's such a child sometimes, she said to Vanion. Can't you think of some way to make him grow up?
I was sort of considering going along, the preceptor replied, smiling. Sparhawk might let me hold his cloak while he kicks in the gate. I don't think anybody's assaulted Hill lately.
You too?
She covered her face with her hands.
Oh, dear.
All right then, gentlemen, she said, giving up. If you're all so bent on this, we'll try it, but only on one condition. If we do find Belium and it restores Alana, we must destroy it immediately after the task is done.
Destroy it? Yulith exploded. Sophrenia, it's the most precious thing in the world.
And also the most dangerous. If Azash ever comes to possess it, the world will be lost, and all mankind will be plunged into the most hideous slavery imaginable. I must insist on this, gentlemen. Otherwise I'll do everything in my power to prevent your finding that accursed stone.
I don't see that we've got much choice here, Yulith said gravely to the others. Without her help, we don't have much hope of unearthing Belium. Oh, somebody's going to find it all right, Sparhawk told him firmly. One of the things Aldreas told me was that the time has come for Belium to see the light of day again, and no force on earth can prevent it. The only thing that concerns me right now is whether it's going to be one of us who finds it, or some Zaymok who'll carry it back to Otha.
Or if it rises from the earth all on its own, Tinian added moodily. Could it do that, Sophrenia? Probably yes.
How did you get out of the chapter house without being seen by the primate's spies? Carlton asked Sparhawk curiously. I threw a rope over the back wall and climbed down.
How about getting in and out of the city after the gates were all closed?
By pure luck, the gate was still open when I was on my way to the cathedral. I used another way to get out.
That garret I told you about? Talon asked.
Sparhawk nodded.
How much did he charge you?
A silver half-crown.
Talon looked shocked at that. And they call me a thief. He gulled you, Sparhawk.
Sparhawk shrugged. I needed to get out of the city.
I'll tell Platamy about it, the boy said. He'll get your money back. A half-crown? That's outrageous!
The boy was actively spluttering.
Sparhawk remembered something.
Sophrenia, when I was on my way back here, something was out in the fog watching me. I don't think it was human.
The Damok?
I couldn't say for sure, but it didn't feel the same. The Damok's not the only creature subject to Azash, is it?
No. The Damok is the most powerful, but it's stupid. The other creatures don't have its power, but they're more clever. In many ways, they can be even more dangerous.
All right, Sophrenia, Vanion said then. I think you'd better give me Tarnas' sword now.
My dear one,
she began to protest, her face anguished.
We've had this argument once already tonight, he told her. Let's not go through it again.
She sighed. Then the two of them began to chant in unison in the Styric tongue. Vanion's face turned a little grayer at the end when Sophrenia handed him the sword, and their hands touched.
All right, Sparhawk said to Yulith after the transfer had been completed. Where do we start? Where was King Sarek when his crown was lost?
No one really knows, the big Genidian knight replied. He left Emsat when Otha invaded Lemurkand. He took a few retainers and left orders for the rest of his army to follow him to the battlefield at Lake Rondera.
Did anyone report having seen him there?
Carlton asked.
Not that I've ever heard.
The Thalesian army was seriously decimated, though. It's possible that Sarek did get there before the battle started, but that none of the few survivors ever saw him.
I expect that's the place to start, then, Sparhawk said. Sparhawk, Euloth objected, that battlefield is immense. All the knights of the church could spend the rest of their lives digging there and still not find the crown.
There's an alternative, Tinian said, scratching his chin. And what is that, friend Tinian? Xavier asked him.
I have some skill at necromancy, Tinian told him. I don't like it much, but I know how it's done. If we can find out where the Thalesians are buried, I can ask them if any of them saw King Sarek on the field, and if any know where he might be buried. It's exhausting, but the cause is worth it.
I'll be able to aid you, Tinian, Sophrenia told him. I don't practice necromancy myself, but I know the proper spells.
Curic rose to his feet. I'd better get the things we'll need together, he said. Come on, Bayret, you too, Talon.
There'll be 10 of us, Sophrenia told him.
10?
We'll be taking Talon and Flute along with us.
Is that really necessary? Sparhawk objected. Or even wise?
Yes, it is. We'll be seeking the aid of some of the younger gods of Styricum, and they like symmetry. We were 10 when we began this search, so now we have to be the same 10 every step of the way. Sudden changes disturb the younger gods.
Anything you say, he shrugged.
Banion rose and began to pace up and down.
We'd better get started with this, he said. It might be safer if you left the chapter house before daylight, and before this fog lifts. Let's not make it too easy for the spies who watch the house.
I'll agree with that, Colton approved. I'd rather not have to race Anius' soldiers all the way to Lake Rondera.
All right, then, Sparhawk said. Let's get at it. Time's running a little short on us.
Stay a moment, Sparhawk, Banion said as they began to file out. Sparhawk waited until the others had left, and then he closed the door.
I received a communication from the Earl of Lender this evening, the preceptor told his friend.
Oh?
He asked me to reassure you. Anius and Lycaeus are taking no further action against the Queen. Apparently, the failure of their plot down in Arsham embarrassed Anius a great deal. He is not going to take the chance of making a fool of himself again.
That's a relief.
Lenda added something I don't quite understand, though. He asked me to tell you that the candles are still burning. Do you have any idea what he meant by that?
Good old Lenda, Sparhawk said warmly.
I asked him not to leave Alana sitting in the throne room in the dark.
I don't think it makes much difference to her, Sparhawk.
It does to me, Sparhawk replied.
Chapter 2 The fog was even thicker when they gathered in the courtyard a quarter of an hour later. The novices were busy in the stables saddling horses. Banion came out through the main door, his styric robe gleaming in the mist-filled darkness.
I'm sending 20 knights with you, he quietly told Sparhawk. You might be followed, and they'll offer some measure of protection.
We sort of need to hurry, Banion, Sparhawk objected. If we take others with us, we won't be able to move any faster than the pace of the slowest horse.
I know that, Sparhawk, Banion replied patiently. You won't need to stay with them for very long. Wait until you're out in open country and the sun comes up. Make sure nobody's too close behind you and then slip away from the column. The knights will ride on to Deimos. If anybody's following, they won't know you aren't still in the middle of the column.
Sparhawk grinned.
Now I know how you got to be preceptor, my friend. Who's leading the column?
Olvan.
Good. Olvan's dependable.
Go with God, Sparhawk. Banion said, clasping the big knight's hand. And be careful.
I'm certainly going to try.
Sir Olvan was a bulky Pandion knight with a number of angry red scars on his face. He came out of the chapter house wearing full armor enameled black. His men trailed out behind him.
Good to see you again, Sparhawk, he said as Banion went back inside.
Olvan spoke very quietly to avoid alerting the church soldiers camped outside the front gate.
All right, he went on. You and the others ride in the middle of us. With this fog, those soldiers probably won't see you.
We'll drop the drawbridge and go out fast. We don't want to be in sight for more than a minute or two.
That's more words than I've heard you use at one time in the last 20 years, Sparhawk said to his normally silent friend.
I know, Ulvan agreed. I'll have to see if I can't cut back a little.
Sparhawk and his friends wore mail shirts and traveler's cloaks, since formal armor would attract attention out in the countryside. Their armor, however, was carefully stowed in packs on the string of a half-dozen horses Kurik would lead. They mounted, and the armored men formed up around them. Ulvan made a signal to the men at the windlass that raised and lowered the drawbridge, and the men slipped the ratchets, allowing the windlass to run freely. There was a noisy rattle of chain, and the drawbridge dropped with a huge boom. Ulvan was galloping across it almost before it hit the far side of the fosse. The dense fog helped enormously. As soon as he had galloped across the bridge, Ulvan cut sharply to the left, leading the column across the open field toward the Deimos Road. Behind them, Sparhawk could hear startled shouts as the church soldiers ran out of their tents to stare after the column in chagrin.
Slick, Calton said gaily, across the drawbridge and into the fog in under a minute.
Ulvan knows what he's doing, Sparhawk said. And what's even better is that it's going to be at least an hour before the soldiers can mount any kind of pursuit.
Give me an hour's head start and they'll never catch me.
Calton laughed delightedly.
This is starting out very well, Sparhawk.
Enjoy it while you can. Things will probably start to go wrong later on.
You're a pessimist, do you know that?
No. I'm just used to little disappointments. They slowed to a canter when they reached the Deimos Road. Ulvan was a veteran, and he always tried to conserve his horses. Speed might be necessary later, and Sir Ulvan took very few chances. A full moon hung above the fog, and it made the thick mist deceptively luminous. The glowing white fog around them confused the eye and concealed far more than it illuminated. There was a chill dampness in the fog, and Sparhawk pulled his cloak about him as he rode. The Deimos Road swung north toward the city of Lenda before turning southeasterly again to Deimos, where the Pandion Mother House was located. Although he could not see it, Sparhawk knew that the countryside along the road was gently rolling, and that there were large patches of trees out there. He was counting on those trees for concealment once he and his friends left the column. They rode on. The fog had dampened the dirt surface of the road, and the sound of their horses' hooves was muffled. Every now and then the black shadows of trees loomed suddenly out of the fog at the sides of the road as they rode by. Talon shied nervously each time it happened.
"What's the problem?" Kurik asked him.
"I hate this," the boy replied. "I absolutely hate it. Anything could be hiding beside the road, wolves, bears, or even worse.
You're in the middle of a party of armed men, Talon.
That's easy for you to say, but I'm the smallest one here, except for Flute, maybe. I've heard that wolves and things like that always drag down the smallest when they attack. I really don't want to be eaten, Father.
That keeps cropping up,
Tinian noted curiously to Sparhawk.
You never did explain why the boy keeps calling your squire by that term.
Kurik was indiscreet when he was younger.
Doesn't anybody in Alania sleep in his own bed?
It's a cultural peculiarity.
It's not really as widespread as it might seem, though.
Tinian rose slightly in his stirrups and looked ahead to where Bavier and Calton rode side by side in deep conversation.
A word of advice, Sparhawk, he said confidentially. You're an Alanian, so you don't seem to have any problem with this sort of thing. And in Deira, we're fairly broad-minded about such things. But I don't know that I'd let Bavier in on this. The Cyrenic Knights are a pious lot, just like all Arshans. And they disapprove of these little irregularities very strongly. Bavier's a good man in a fight, but he's a little narrow-minded. If he gets offended, it might cause problems later on.
You're probably right, Sparhawk agreed. I'll talk with Talon and ask him to keep his relationship with Kurik to himself.
Do you think he'll listen?
The broad-faced Deiran asked skeptically.
It's worth a try.
They occasionally passed a farmhouse standing beside the foggy road with hazy golden lamplight streaming from its windows, a sure sign that even though the sky had not yet started to lighten, day had already begun for the country folk.
How long are we going to stay with this column? Tinian asked. Going to Lake Rundera by way of Deimos is a very long way around. We can probably slip away later this morning, Sparhawk replied, once we're sure that nobody's following us. That's what Vanion suggested. Have you got somebody watching to the rear? Sparhawk nodded. Bayrit's riding about a half mile back. Do you think any of the primate spies saw us leave your chapter house? They didn't really have very much time for it, Sparhawk said. We'd already gone past them before they came out of their tents. Tinian grunted. Which road do you plan to take when we leave this one? I think we'll go across country. Roads tend to be watched. I'm sure that Aeneas has guessed that we're up to something by now. They rode on through the tag end of a foggy night. Sparhawk was pensive. He privately admitted to himself that their hastily conceived plan had little chance of success. Even if Tinian could raise the ghosts of the Thalesian dead, there was no guarantee that any of the spirits would know the location of King Sarek's final resting place. This entire journey could well be futile, and serve only to use up what time Alana had left. Then a thought came to him. He rode on forward to speak with Sophrenia. Something just occurred to me, he said to her.
Oh?
How well known is the spell you used to encase Alana?
It's almost never practiced because it's so very dangerous, she replied. A few Styrix might know of it, but I doubt that any would dare to perform it. Why do you ask?
I think I'm right on the edge of an idea. If no one but you is really willing to use the spell, then it's rather unlikely that anybody else would know about the time limitation.
That's true, they wouldn't.
Then nobody could tell Aeneas about it.
Obviously.
So Aeneas doesn't know that we only have so much time left. For all he knows, the crystal could keep Alana alive indefinitely.
I'm not certain that gives us any particular advantage, Sparhawk.
I'm not either, but it's something to keep in mind. We might be able to use it someday.
The eastern sky was growing gradually lighter as they rode, and the fog was swirling and thinning. It was about a half hour before sunrise when Bayrit came galloping up from the rear. He was wearing his mail shirt and plain blue cloak, and his war axe was in a sling at the side of his saddle. The young novice, Sparhawk decided almost idly, was going to need some instruction in swordsmanship soon, before he grew too attached to that axe.
Sir Sparhawk, he said, reining in, there's a column of church soldiers coming up behind us.
His hard-run horse was steaming in the chill fog.
How many? Sparhawk asked him.
50 or so, and they're galloping hard. There was a break in the fog, and I saw them coming.
How far back?
A mile or so. They're in that valley we just came through.
Sparhawk considered it.
I think a little change of plans might be in order, he said.
He looked around and saw a dark blur back in the swirling fog off to the left.
Tinian, he said, I think that's a grove of trees over there. Why don't you take the others and ride across this field and get into the grove before the soldiers catch up? I'll be right along. He shook Farron's reins. I want to talk with Sir Ulvan, he told the big roan.
Farron flicked his ears irritably, then moved alongside the column at a gallop.
We'll be leaving you here, Ulvan, Sparhawk told the scar-faced knight. There's a half-hundred church soldiers coming up from the rear. I want to be out of sight before they come by.
Good idea, Ulvan approved.
Ulvan was not one to waste words.
Why don't you give them a bit of a run, Sparhawk suggested. They won't be able to tell that we're not still in the column until they catch up with you.
Ulvan grinned crookedly.
Even so far as Deimos? He asked.
That would be helpful.
Cut across country before you reach Lenda, and pick up the road again south of town. I'm sure Aeneas has spies in Lenda, too.
Good luck, Sparhawk, Ulvan said.
Thanks, Sparhawk said, shaking the scar-faced knight's hand. We might need it.
He backed Farron off the road, and the column thundered past him at a gallop.
Let's see how fast you can get to that grove of trees over there, Sparhawk said to his bad-tempered mount.
Farron snorted derisively, then leaped forward at a dead run.
Calton waited at the edge of the trees, his gray cloak blending into the shadows and fog.
The others are back in the woods a ways, he reported. Why is Ulvan galloping like that?
I asked him to, Sparhawk replied, swinging down from his saddle. The soldiers won't know that we've left the column if Olvin stays a mile or two ahead of them.
You're smarter than you look, Sparhawk, Colton said, also dismounting. I'll get the horses back out of sight. The steam coming off them might be visible.
He squinted at Farron. Tell this ugly brute of yours not to bite me.
You heard him, Farron, Sparhawk told his warhorse.
Farron laid his ears back. As Colton led their horses back among the trees, Sparhawk sank down onto his stomach behind a low bush. The grove of trees lay no more than 50 yards from the road. As the fog began to dissipate with the onset of morning, he could clearly see that the whole stretch of road they had just left was empty. Then, a single red-tuniced soldier galloped along, coming from the south. The man rode stiffly, and his face seemed strangely wooden.
A scout? Colton whispered, crawling up beside Sparhawk.
More than likely, Sparhawk whispered back.
Why are we whispering? Colton asked. He can't hear us over the noise of his horse's hooves.
You started it.
Force of habit, I guess. I always whisper when I'm skulking.
The scout reined in his mount at the top of the hill, then wheeled, and rode back along the road at a dead run. His face was still blank.
He's going to wear out that horse if he keeps doing that, Colton said.
It's his horse.
That's true, and he's the one who gets to walk when the horse plays out on him.
Walking is good for church soldiers. It teaches them humility. About 5 minutes later, the church soldiers galloped by, their red tunics dark in the dawn light. Accompanying the leader of the column was a tall, emaciated figure in a black robe and hood. It might have been a trick of the misty morning light, but a faint greenish glow seemed to emanate from under the hood, and the figure's back appeared to be grossly deformed.
They're definitely trying to keep an eye on that column, Colton said.
I hope they enjoy Deimos, Sparhawk replied. Olvin's going to stay ahead of them every step of the way.
I need to talk with Sophronia. Let's go back to the others. We'll sit tight for an hour or so until we're sure the soldiers are out of the area, and then move on.
Good idea. I'm about ready for some breakfast anyway. They led their horses back through the damp woods to a small basin surrounding a trickling spring that emerged from a fern-covered bank.
Did they go by? Tinian asked.
At a gallop, Colton grinned. And they didn't look around very much.
Does anybody have anything to eat? I'm starving.
I've got a slab of cold bacon, Kurek offered.
Cold?
Fire makes smoke, Colton. Do you really want these woods full of soldiers?
Colton sighed.
Sparhawk looked at Sophronia.
There's somebody or something riding with those soldiers, he said.
It gave me a very uneasy feeling, and I think it was the same thing I caught a glimpse of last night.
Can you describe it?
It's quite tall and very, very thin. Its back seems to be deformed, and it's wearing a black hooded robe, so I couldn't see any details. He frowned.
Those church soldiers in the column seem to be half asleep. They usually pay closer attention to what they're doing.
This thing you saw, she said seriously, was there anything else unusual about it?
I can't say for sure, but it seemed to have a sort of greenish light coming from its face. I noticed the same thing last night.
Her face grew bleak.
I think we'd better leave immediately, Sparhawk.
The soldiers don't know we're here, he objected.
They will before long. You've just described a seeker. In Zamok they're used to hunt down runaway slaves. The lump on its back is caused by its wings.
Wings? Colton said skeptically. Sophronia, no animal has wings except maybe a bat.
This isn't a mammal, Colton, she replied. It more closely resembles an insect.
Although neither term is very exact when you're talking about the creatures Azash summons.
I hardly think we need to worry about a bug, he said.
We do with this particular creature. It has very little in the way of a brain, but that doesn't matter, because the spirit of Azash infuses it and provides its thoughts for it. It can see a long ways in the dark or fog. Its ears are very sharp, and it has a very keen sense of smell. As soon as those soldiers come in sight of Ulvan's column, it's going to know that we're not riding with the knights. The soldiers will come back at that point.
Are you saying that church soldiers will take orders from an insect?
Xavier asked incredulously.
They have no choice. They have no will of their own anymore. The Seeker controls them utterly.
How long does that last?
He asked her.
For as long as they live,
which usually isn't very long. As soon as it has no further need of them, it consumes them. Sparhawk, we're in very great danger. Let's leave here at once.
You heard her, Sparhawk said grimly. Let's get out of here.
They rode out of the grove of trees at a canter and crossed a wide green meadow where brown and white spotted cows grazed in knee-deep grass. Sir Euleth pulled in beside Sparhawk.
It's really none of my business, the shaggy-browed Genidian knight said. But you had 20 pandions with you back there. Why didn't you just turn around and eliminate those soldiers and their bug?
50 dead soldiers scattered along a road would attract attention, Sparhawk explained. And new graves are almost as obvious.
Makes sense, I guess, Euleth grunted. Living in an overpopulated kingdom has its own special problems, doesn't it? Up in Thalesia, the trolls and ogres usually clean up that sort of thing before anybody chances by.
Sparhawk shuddered.
Will they really eat carrion? He asked, looking back over his shoulder for any sign of pursuit. Trolls and ogres? Oh, yes. As long as the carrion's not too ripe. A nice fat church soldier will feed a family of trolls for a week or so. That's one of the reasons there aren't very many church soldiers or their graveyards in Thalesia. The point, though, is that I don't like leaving live enemies behind me. Those church soldiers might come back to haunt us. And if that thing they've got with them is as dangerous as Sophrenia says, we probably should have gotten it out of the way while we had the chance.
Maybe you're right, Sparhawk admitted. But it's too late now, I'm afraid. Ulvan's far out of reach. About all we can do is make a run for it and hope the soldiers' horses play out before ours do. When we get a chance, I'll want to talk with Sophrenia some more about that Seeker. I've got a feeling there were some things about it she wasn't telling me. They rode hard for the rest of the day and saw no signs that the soldiers were anywhere behind them.
There's a roadside inn just ahead, Calton said as evening settled over the rolling countryside. Do you want to chance it?
Sparhawk looked at Sophrenia.
What do you think?
Only for a few hours, she said. Just long enough to feed the horses and give them some rest. The Seeker knows that we're not with that column by now, and it's certain to be following our trail. We have to move on.
We could at least get some supper, Calton added, and maybe a couple hours of sleep. I've been up for a long time. Besides, we might be able to pick up some information if we ask the right questions.
The inn was run by a thin, good-humored fellow and his plump, jolly wife. It was a comfortable place and meticulously clean. The broad fireplace at one end of the common room did not smoke, and there were fresh rushes on the floor.
We don't see many city folk this far out in the country, the innkeeper noted as he brought a platter of roast beef to the table. And very seldom any knights. At least I judge from your garb that you're knights. What brings you this way, my lords?
We're on our way to Pelosia, Calton lied easily. Church business. We're in a hurry, so we decided to cut across country.
There's a road that runs on up into Pelosia, about 3 leagues to the south, the innkeeper advised helpfully.
Roads wander around a lot, Calton said. And as I told you, we're in a hurry.
Anything interesting happening hereabouts? Tinian asked, as if only mildly curious. The innkeeper laughed wryly.
What can possibly happen in a place like this? The local farmers spend all their time talking about a cow that died 6 months ago.
He drew up a chair and sat down uninvited. He sighed.
I used to live in Simara when I was younger. Now there's a place where things really happen. I miss all the excitement.
What made you decide to move out here? Calton asked, spearing another slice of beef with his dagger.
My father left me this place when he died. Nobody wanted to buy it, so I didn't have any choice.
He frowned slightly.
Now that you mention it, though, he said, returning to the previous topic,
There has been something a little unusual happening around here for the last few months.
Oh? Tinian said carefully.
We've been seeing bands of roving Styrix. The countryside's crawling with them. They don't usually move around that much, do they?
Not really, Sophronia replied. We're not a nomadic people.
I thought you might be Styrix, lady, judging from your looks and your clothes. We've got a Styrix village not far from here. They're nice enough people, I suppose, but they keep pretty much to themselves.
He leaned back in his chair.
I do think you Styrix could avoid a lot of the trouble that breaks out from time to time if you'd just mingle with your neighbors a little more.
It's not our way, Sophronia murmured. I don't believe Alines and Styrix are supposed to mingle.
There could be something to what you say, he agreed.
Are these Styrix doing anything in particular?
Sparhawk asked, keeping his voice neutral.
Asking questions is about all. They seem to be very curious about the Zamok War for some reason.
He rose to his feet.
Enjoy your supper, he said, and went back to the kitchen.
We have a problem, Sophronia said gravely. Western Styrix do not wander about the countryside. Our gods prefer to have us stay close to their altars.
Zamoks, then, Bavia surmised.
Almost certainly.
When I was in Lamarcan, there were reports of Zamoks infiltrating the country east of Moterra, Colton remembered. They were doing the same thing, wandering about the country, asking questions, mostly having to do with folklore.
Azash seems to have a plan that closely resembles ours, Sophronia said.
He's trying to gather information that will lead him to Belium.
It's a race, then, Colton said.
I'm afraid so. And he's got Zamoks out there ahead of us.
And church soldiers behind, Euloth added. You've gone and got us surrounded, Sparhawk. Could that Seeker be controlling those wandering Zamoks the same way it's controlling the soldiers? The big Thalesian asked Sophronia. We could be riding into an ambush if it is, you know.
I'm not entirely certain, she replied. I've heard a great deal about Otha's Seekers, but I've never actually seen one in action.
You didn't have time to be very specific this morning, Sparhawk said. Exactly how is that thing controlling Anius' soldiers?
It's venomous, she said. Its bite paralyzes the will of its victims, or of those it wants to dominate.
I'll make a point of not letting it bite me, then, Colton said.
You may not be able to stop it, she told him. That green glow is hypnotic. That makes it easier for it to get close enough to inject the venom.
How fast can it fly? Tinian asked.
It doesn't fly at this stage of its development, she replied. Its wings don't mature until it becomes an adult. Besides, it has to be on the ground to follow the scent of the one it's trying to catch. Normally it travels on horseback, and since the horse is controlled in the same way people are, the Seeker simply rides the horse to death and then finds another. It can cover a great deal of ground that way.
What does it eat? Hurek asked. Maybe we can set a trap for it.
It feeds primarily on humans, she told him.
That would make baiting a trap a little difficult, he admitted. They all went to bed directly after supper, but it seemed to Sparhawk that his head had no sooner touched the pillow than Keurig shook him awake.
It's about midnight, the squire said.
All right, Sparhawk said wearily, sitting up in bed.
I'll wake the others, Keurig said, and then Bayrit and I'll go saddle the horses.
After he had dressed, Sparhawk went downstairs to have a word with the sleepy innkeeper.
Tell me, neighbor, he said. Is there by any chance a monastery hereabouts?
The innkeeper scratched his head.
I think there's one near the village of Veyrani, he replied. That's about 5 leagues east of here.
Thanks, neighbor, Sparhawk said. He looked around.
You've got a nice comfortable inn here, he said, and your wife keeps clean beds and sets a very fine table. I'll mention your place to my friends.
Why, that's very kind of you, Sir Knight. Sparhawk nodded to him and went outside to join the others.
End of Side 1. To continue, turn the cassette over.